Okay, so let us begin our limud of the third parak of Sanhedrin with an obvious starting point, which is the first Mishnah in the parak. So the parak begins on parak and daf chav gimel and aleph masechta Sanhedrin, and the Mishnah, which again we have copies of the Gemara if people need, says as follows: Dinei mamonos b'shlosha. When you have a monetary dispute and you need a beis din, you have three dayanim, three judges. How do you appoint those judges? Zeh borer lo echad, v'zeh borer lo echad, u'shnehen borerin lohen od echad. So the Mishnah here, we're just going to translate the words. This appoints one, and the two of them appoint an additional one. Now what these ones refer to, and what zeh refers to, okay, is going to be a discussion in the Gemara. There are going to be multiple approaches to that, so we'll leave it ambiguous for now. Just to forecast the conclusion of the Gemara, we're really going to say that each one appoints one judge, and together they appoint a third judge. But we're going to see that there are multiple hava aminas. There are multiple suggestions that are put forward by the Gemara before we reach that conclusion. So then we have, after we've established that it's three judges, Zebor Lo'echad, Zebor Lo'echad, Ushneim Bor Lo'echad, Odechad, the Mishnah quotes three disputes between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. So, Ushnehen borin lahen od echad divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says the two of them appoint a third judge. V'chachamim omrim shnei dayonin borin lahen od echad. First dispute in the Mishnah is who appoints the third judge. According to Rabbi Meir, it's the two ba'alei dinim, the two litigants, who appoint the third judge. According to the Chachamim, it's the first two judges who together convene and appoint the third judge. Okay, machlokas number one. Next, two. Zeh posel dayano shel zeh, zeh posel dayano shel zeh, divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir holds that each person can disqualify the judge that is appointed by the other party. V'chachamim omrim, em asai. V'chachamim say, when can this be done? When can one disqualify the other person's appointed judge? Bizman shemevi alein raya shehin krovin opsulin. If you bring a proof that they are either, that they have some form of formal disqualification, that they are a karov, they're a relative, and that's one form of disqualification, or they're psulin, there's some other reason why they're disqualified from offering testimony. Either they're rishaim, or there are certain hereditary psulin that may exist. So the Chachamim say, if you marshal evidence that they have a formal disqualification, then you can disqualify them. According to Rabbi Meir, at least at the outset, it seems like you can disqualify them just because you decide that you don't like them. You don't like the way they look, you don't like the fact that he's wearing a hat, or he's not wearing a hat, or whatever the type of tcheles tzitzis or non-tcheles, you can disqualify them for any reason, okay? Some people might say that that is enough to qualify for Russia. But assuming that it's not, you can, according to Rabbi Meir, you can still disqualify them. That's machlokas number two. I'm sorry, I stopped too early again. Maybe Alain Rayashain Krobin Opsulin, Avalim Hayuk Sherin, O Mumchin Mipi Bastin, Eno Yacholoposan. If they were Ksherim, if they were just normal people who were kosher, or if they were Mumchin, this kind of expertise, we'll have to explore in the Gemara what exactly that refers to, then you cannot disqualify them. Third machlokas. Zeb posel Eidov Shal Zeh, Vizeb posel Eidov Shal Zeh, Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir takes a giant step further, at least seemingly, and says that not only can you disqualify the other person's judges, you can also disqualify his witnesses. Now, obviously, that's a remarkable statement. You can just throw out another person's witnesses because you decide that you don't like them. And the Gemara is going to explore what exactly that means, and we're going to have multiple suggestions as to what Rabbi Meir actually means by that. But let's just finish the Mishnah for now. V'chachamim omrim, v'chachamim say, eimasai, when are you able to disqualify the other person's witnesses? Again, bizman shemevi alehin raya shein kroven opsulin. If you indeed prove that there is some form of halachic formal disqualification, then you can get rid of them. If you just decide that you don't like them, then you can't get rid of them. If you just decide you don't like them, but otherwise they're fully qualified, you cannot disqualify them. That is the Mishnah. Again, three judges, as we'll see. The Gemara is going to have to take some time to reach that conclusion, but we'll just deliver the forecast or deliver the conclusion in advance. Three judges, and then three disputes between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. Number one, how is the third judge appointed by the two litigants or by the first two judges? Number two, can you disqualify the other person's appointed judge just on a whim? And number three, can you disqualify the other person's witnesses just on a whim? Fine, that's the Mishnah. Now, whenever we read a Mishnah, and the Mishnah quotes three different disputes, it behooves us to ask whether these happen to be three halachos with some very broad general theme, i.e. beis din, that happened to be included in the same Mishnah, or when the the redactor of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who's redacting the Mishnah, decides to put these in a single Mishnah, is there some form of common denominator that unites these three halachos? So I open that up as a question.
I would think they don't necessarily have to all be dependent upon one another, or necessarily related, given that the Mishnayos generally were put together in a way that will help you remember them, but doesn't necessarily mean that.
Okay, you can say that, or you can say that there is some form of thematic parallel.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think they're interdependent, but they do seem to remain in the hums of have a common sort of philosophy about it.
Okay, that's what I'm looking for, yeah.
Mayer says that once you're making this sort of painted, you can do whatever you want. There are basically no rules, and until you can both come to an agreement, you can do whatever you want, and both agree on the three judges. And Chachamim saying no, like there's some like formal way in which this works. Like you can't do whatever you want. You have to, this basin comes together. It has to come together eventually. And so there are rules about how that works. And
right.
You...
So perfect. So if we're looking through the three machlokos in the Mishnah, and we'll leave the third one aside right now, because disqualifying another person's witnesses, as we will see, is heavily limited in terms of the circumstances by the Gemara. The Gemara is going to throw out different suggestions as to when you can actually just disqualify another person's witnesses. And that will get us into a whole host of other sugyas about Yachol Levarer, Tzarech Levarer, and Eidos Nogea B'davar, and other things like that. So we'll leave the third one aside. But if we're noting a general trend, I think Jerry is correct. And just to put it in slightly more precise terms, Rabbi Meir increases the koach, or the power, of the litigants here. The Ba'alei Dinim, it's kechomer b'yad hayotzer, almost. It's in their hands to shape what this Beis Din is going to look like. They are allowed to, they are the ones who are instructed to choose the third dayan. They have the power to disqualify the other person's dayan. Okay? He really increases the power of the litigants. Whereas the Chachamim hold, once you've made your appointments, you have some role to play in the process, at least kicking the process off, but once you kick the process off, there is some form of formal structure, and the court takes on its own stature. You don't have the power to just shape it however you want. That's going to be very significant, and Be'ezus Hashem will come back to that, because it may have major conceptual ramifications in terms of how we understand this entire concept of Zeb Borer Lo Echad. We're often going to refer to Zeb Borer Lo Echad as Zavla, Zeb Borer Lo Echad. It's commonly referred to as Beis Din Shel Zabla, or Zabla. So we're going to have to explore the nature of this Beis Din Shel Zabla, and this machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim may not be a series of three arbitrary disputes, but may pertain to the very nature of what this Beis Din is all about. Okay? So before we get back to that, let's at least read the Gemara. The Gemara will take us through, let's halfway through Chalf Gimel Amud Aleph, and let's see what the Gemara has to say. Okay? So the Gemara begins with the question, "My zeb borer lo echad v'zeb borer lo echad." What does it mean, zeb borer lo echad v'zeb borer lo echad? Right, as we noted, the language is a bit ambiguous. Bitlasa sagi, three judges should be enough. Okay, that is our girsa in the Gemara. That is the girsa of Rashi. As we will see, other Rishonim disagree with this. But for now, let's just work with Rashi's explanation. So for Rashi, we go to the first Rashi. On the page, top right, Zeb Borer Lo Echad. This is Rashi on the Mishnah. Mashma, this implies, Zeb Borer Lo Beis Din Echad, Shehein Gimel. V'Zeh Echad Harei Shisha. So this one appoints his own Beis Din, that gives you three judges. And this person appoints his own Beis Din, that gives you six. U'Shnehen Borerim Lohen Od Echad Harei Tes, Harei Tisha. And again, then they together appoint a third Beis Din. So now you have a court consisting of nine judges. V'hainu dekametama, and this is why the Gemara asks, Maize borer habitlas hasagi. This is why the Gemara says, why do you need nine judges? Three judges should be sufficient. This is Rashi's way of learning that line in the Gemara. As we will see, there are many Rishonim who will dispute Rashi's reading for a number of reasons, for textual reasons and for logical reasons. One of the questions that's leveled by the Tosfos HaRosh on Rashi is, why would we ever think that you would need nine why would we ever have a Havamina that you'd need nine? Why would we ever read the Mishnah that way? And Rishonim have textual questions. The first words of the Mishnah are, Dine Mamonos Beshlosha. So you need three, and then the next line in the Mishnah is telling me that we need nine. The Rishonim have a hard time wrapping their head around Rashi. And we're going to explore Rashi a little bit more as we go along. Why would we ever have a Havamina to think that you'd need nine judges? But for now, We'll just stick with Rashi's reading of the Gemara. The first approach in the Gemara is that you need 9. And the Gemara asks, why do you need 9? 3 should be sufficient. Yeah.
Do those Rishonim or do any Rishonim assume that the question is, what is that, shouldn't there be, if you have Zebar Lalecha, Zebar Lalecha, that's until 4 litigants, meaning that really they could have kept one other, that's what I thought that I couldn't say, that they could have picked one Daya and then essentially 3 of them.
Could have been a Beis Din?
Or some sort of like arbitration.
I would have loved for someone to have said that. That would be really radical. I haven't seen anybody who says that. That would be pretty remarkable.
That would be.
It usually refers to the judges, right? When we're talking about Minu Dayanik.
Yeah, for sure.
Any Mamonos Bishlosha, like those 3 words, it's not. That can't be referring to litigants. Like, because
well, Jerry's taking an extreme position here, which
you could have like a case where there's like more than one litigant. So this is, it's not talking about a classic case where it's like one litigant versus another person and then one judge. You know what I'm saying? Like this is referring, no?
That's how I thought.
Look, Zach is definitely pointing out a pretty fair point, which is why, again, I don't think anyone from, I mean, again, Jerry's opinion itself is very significant to me and I think to us, but
significant to me.
But certainly in the standard corpus of Rishonim and Achronim, I haven't seen anybody who says that. I think it would be remarkable and very exciting to me if somebody did. That would have important ramifications for the sugya. But there are 3 approaches, mainstream approaches in the Rishonim, 2 in addition to Rashi, and none of them are suggesting that the litigants should be included. Okay, fine. So the Gemara asks, "Ma'izavar lo'echav zavar lo'echav betlas asagi." 3 should be sufficient. The Gemara answers, "Hachi ka'amar." This is what the Mishnah really means to say. Kishazeh borer lo based in echad. Kishazeh. Okay, those 2 letters are going to be important as well. Not zeh borer lo echad. It's not instructing you that this is what you should do. But kishazeh, when the circumstance arises, that this one appoints a based in, and this one appoints another based in, shnehen borerin lohen od echad. The 2 of them will come together for a 3rd based in. The Gemara at this stage is suggesting as follows. What does the Mishnah mean? Reuven and Shimon have a case. Reuven wants to go to the Beis Din in Pelham Parkway, and Shimon wants to go to the Beis Din in Riverdale, and they can't come to an agreement, okay? We throw out both of those 2 Batei Din, and the 2 of them must come up with a 3rd Beis Din to go to. They go to the Beis Din of America in Washington Heights, okay? I highly doubt there's a Beis Din in Pelham Parkway anymore. Maybe at one point in the history of Pelham Parkway there was. But the 2 of them get together, and they go to a Beis Din that they can't agree upon. This is the question of what happens when they dispute, not about an ad hoc basin, but about formal Batei Din. There's 1 basin in place X, one in Minsk, 1 in Pinsk. They can't decide which one to go to. Where do they go? That's an important sugya as well. It comes up here, and on Daf Lamed Aleph, it will be the 2nd sugya that we explore. The relationship between our current sugya and that sugya is also going to be an important question. But for now, again, keeping things simple, the 2nd Hava Amina in the Gemara is that it's a case where each person chooses their own Beis Din. They can't agree, so they have to come to some conclusion about which Beis Din they're going to go to. Now, the Gemara challenges this. Va'afilu loveh matzi ma'akev, the Gemara asks. Is it true that the loveh is able to indeed veto the Beis Din chosen by the malveh? Malveh and loveh, a malveh is a lender, a loveh is a borrower. Is it true that the borrower is able to veto the Beis Din that is chosen by the lender? Is that really the case? V'ha'amar Rabbi Elazar, but don't we have it recorded that Rabbi Elazar once said, and again, this is the Gemara in Daf Lamed Aleph at the very end of Perek Zeborer, which we will examine hopefully soon. Lo shanu ela malve, ava lova kofet osova dan be'iro. Didn't Rabbi Elazar tell us that really only the malve is able to reject the basin appointed by the love, but not vice versa? The malve has a certain power over the love. We'll have to explore why he has that power and what the nature of that power is. But he has some additional power whereby he is able to reject the court chosen by the borrower, but the borrower is not able to reject the basin chosen by the lender. So how can you tell me that each one can reject the others in the Mishnah if that's not really the case, if it's only true that one party has the power to reject the other's basin? So the Gemara answers, "Kid Amar Rabbi Yochanan, be'arkaos shebesuria shanu." It's like Rabbi Yochanan said. It's in the case of arkaos shebesuria. This is going to be a very important line. We're going to come back to this line a little later because the exact context of Rabbi Yochanan is going to be important to examine. Hachanami be'arkaos shebesuria shanu. Here also we're dealing with arkaos shebesuria. Again, for simplicity's sake, arkaos shebesuria are some form of inferior based. How inferior they are is the discussion in the Rishon. Do they not know anything? Are they just not the best Talmidei Chachamim ever? That's going to be two positions quoted in the Chiddush Aran on Sanhedrin. The Chiddush Aran on Sanhedrin, we're not sure, from what I understand, if it's really the Ran. It's definitely somebody from that general school, what we call the Catalonian school of Rishonim, the Rishonim from Christian Spain. We often talk about Chachmei Sfarad, right? The Rishonim from Spain. So, in truth, that's a conflation of two different intellectual cultures. If you know a little bit about the medieval history of Spain, it was constantly going back and forth between Christians and Muslims. You had the Moorish, what?
And different Muslims.
And different groups of Muslims as well, which is critical also. So you had the Moors who came from North Africa, and then there was the Spanish Reconquista. There were all these crusades declared in order to take back Spain. It was really the only lasting success of the crusades was the Spanish Crusade. I mean, they also had the internal crusades where they burned a lot of Jews and stuff like that. But the only lasting military conquest was the conquest of Spain. You know, Jerusalem they took, but lost very quickly. Really, the only lasting victory for the Crusaders was the conquest of Spain. So that leads to two distinct intellectual cultures. One is Muslim Spain. That's the Spain of the Rif, the Rimigash, the Rambam, the Adrama. They're from Muslim Spain. That community is wiped out in the 1140s, as Jerry was referring to. There were different Muslim groups. At one point, a radical group from North Africa called the Almohads come to Spain, and they begin annihilating all the Jews, which is why the Rambam's family runs to North Africa. They start first run to Morocco. They end up in Egypt. So that's one intellectual culture. Second is what we refer to as the Catalonian school. So once the Christians start taking back Spain in the northeast, there's that region called Catalonia, which is a distinct cultural and ethnic region. They're constantly suing for independence now. They don't want to be part of Spain. They have their own language, Catalan, which is similar to Spanish but slightly distinct. And that's a separate group of Rishonim. It's important to realize that because they really are very different intellectually. The Chachmei Sfarad HaNotzri, as we call them, the Rishonim from Christian Spain, the Ramban, the Rashba, the Ritva, the Ra'a, the Ran, Rabbeinu David, who comes up prominently in Masechet Sanhedrin, they are all a distinct culture. It's easy to remember because the Ramban had a very famous disputation with Pablo Cristiani in 1263 in Barcelona, who was a Jewish apostate who tried to argue that the Talmud was proved that Jesus was the Messiah. We know that the Ramban handily dealt with Pablo Cristiani. He was a much bigger Talmud Chacham than Pablo Cristiani was, and a much better hold. What? A lot of it was from the last parak of Masechet Sanhedrin is called Chelek, which deals a lot with the eschaton. So there's a lot of material there about Zman HaMashiach, and that was a source of their debates. And recently scholars have tried to revive, maybe Pablo Cristiani did better than has traditionally been assumed. I don't think, or Dr. Berger certainly didn't think that was a much very compelling argument. So that's Christian Spain. Now, it's important to realize that they're different. One very important difference between them is that the Rishonim from Christian Spain are dealing with the contributions of the Baalei HaTosfos. They have the intellectual productivity of France and Germany, and they're building on it. Whereas the Rambam was largely, to a large degree, unaware of what was going on in the writings of Rabbeinu Tam. Or not the writings of Rabbeinu Tam, but the teachings of Rabbeinu Tam. And we know that Rabbeinu Tam really revolutionized Talmudic learning. If we talk about paradigm shifts in the development of learning, right, we talk about people who really totally changed the way the discipline works. In modern times, we talk about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and his contributions to changing the way people approach learning in yeshivos. In the times of the Rishonim, was really Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam introduces this method called dialectic, where he takes the entire corpus of Shas, compares different lines, and starts working out discrepancies, which is really radically different from the way the Gaonim operated on the whole. And that very much changes the way Talmudic learning is conducted. So the fact that the Ramban has Rabbeinu Tam and the Ri, and is working on that and kind of taking it to the next level, and the Rashba and the Ritva are all building on the Ramban's contributions, really makes it very distinct from Chachmei Sfarad of the Rif and the Rambam and the like. So it's just important to be aware of those general differences. So this is all tangential because we're going to be quoting the Chiddush HaRan a lot. The Chiddush HaRan, again, I don't think it's so clear that it was written by the Ran. It's definitely someone from that school of Rishonim. He quotes Rabbeinu David frequently. Rabbeinu David was one of the great students of the Ramban, a very creative thinker. So there are two disputes. There's a dispute as to what Arkaos HaBasuria are. Are they total Amaratzim, or are they people who know just less than the standard judges? But in short, what we have is as follows. Usually, it is true that only the Malve is able to reject the other person's appointed Beis Din. When the Malve appoints an inferior Beis Din, then the Lova has the right to reject his Beis Din as well. So if they both appoint competent Batei Din, only the Malve has the right to reject. the Malveh is trying to force the Loveh to go to this inferior Beis Din who's really not properly equipped to deal with the Halacha, then even the Loveh can say, no, I'm not abiding by this. I'm not going to that Beis Din, okay? So, yeah,
so
sure.
Our kosher basuria is like it's not that's not specific. It's
a category. It's a category. Yeah.
Rashi seems to think that it's specific because she says her kosher basuria shelo yibikima din Torah hilgacha feel a little bit like.
Yeah, no. So obviously, Surya is a place, right? So they serve as a paradigm of Surya got a bad reputation for being a place where there were inferior Batei Din. Obviously, it wouldn't be particular to that locale.
Right.
It's any Beis Din that's comparable to those Batei Din in Surya. I have a friend who's doing doctoral work in Talmud in NYU. A friend of mine, Rabbi Avi Miller from Beth Shalom, is getting a PhD in Talmud now. So he wrote a paper on Surya. It was actually very cool. Different Tanaic and Amoraic perceptions of Surya, and he wrote like on the Arkosh of Surya also. Yeah, and that's the historical research. I don't know anything about that. And for our purposes, it's really immaterial. But the point is, it's an interesting historical question, not an interesting legal halachic question. For our purposes, it's a stand-in for a certain type of Beis Din. Okay. So approach number one, you need 9 judges. Reject that. Clearly, you only need 3. Approach number two, each one is appointing his own Beis Din. And each one has the ability to reject. Why does the Loveh have the ability to reject? Because the Malveh chose an inferior Beis Din. Aval Momchen lo. If they chose a qualified Beis Din, the Loveh would not be able to reject. Now we're up to Rav Papa. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lines, I think, into the Gemara. Rav Papa Amar. Rav Papa gives another way that the Loveh is able to reject the Malveh. Again, going to be very critical for us later on. Afilu tema Momchen. Even in a case where both litigants appointed a qualified expert Beis Din, there are going to be some cases where the Loveh can reject the appointed Beis Din of the Malveh. What case? Kigon, for example, Beidina de Rav Huna ud Rav Chista. The courts of Rav Huna and Rav Chista. Rav Huna was the Rebbe of Rav Chista, which may be an important point that we might address, we may not get into. But they were also, importantly, either from the same exact town or they were both local. Again, different interpretations of the Rishonim, but they're both local. They're close to one another. So why, in that case, is the Loveh able to reject the Malveh's appointed Beis Din? To ka'amar le mikam atrach nalacha? Because the Loveh can say to the Malveh, what is the big deal? You said go to the Beis Din on Morris Park. I said go to the Beis Din on Eastchester, assuming that they're right at this intersection, at the Starbucks, okay? They're close to each other. It's not a big deal. They're both within a certain walking distance, okay? What is the big deal? Why does this bother you? So because they are both within a particular radius, what exactly that radius is, we can discuss, but because they're both within a certain proximity to one another, even the Loveh can reject the Malveh's Beis Din, okay? So two ways that the Loveh can reject the Malveh's Beis Din, either he appoints an inferior quality Beis Din, or they both appoint quality Batei Din, but they're both within the same area, so it's no big deal. So that's approach number two.
Why are we giving them that right,
though? Why? Okay, good. We'll explore this much further when we do this. Okay. It's a good question. It's a critical question, actually. It's a particularly critical question because, as we will see, the Rambam, when he's passing all these halachos, leaves out this halach. He leaves out this right of the Loveh to protest when the two Batei Din are close to one another. So, which further highlights question that you're raising, right? Obviously the Rambam didn't think it's true, at least the Maskana, and we're going to have to talk about why, but for another time. So now the Gemara is going rejects the second approach as well. Tanan, we learned in the Mishnah, that who appoints the third judge or set of judges? The first two judge or sets of judges. If you want to say that each one appointed a certain local Beis Din, and they each rejected the other's Beis Din, based in Basar de Pasi Luhu Azlu Uvar Luhu Beidina Achrini. Once you've rejected those Batei Din, now this is not an obvious assertion of the Gemara, but it's an understandable one. Once you've rejected them, they no longer have anything to do with this case. What is it their business to be appointing a third Beis Din? If you want to tell me, like you were saying originally, that all 9 of them are going to sit on the court, then I understand why those first two sets of judges have a continued role in appointing the third set of judges. They are, after all, involved in this case. If you want to say that each one has rejected the other person's Beis Din, and that they're gone, why exactly should they have any continued role in appointing the third Beis Din? So option number 2 is down. They reject that as well. The Ode, I'm going to ask an additional question. Maize boro lo echad, v'ze boro lo echad. The Gemara's question here is, why, if, okay, second question that the Gemara poses, this is a linguistic challenge to the second approach. Zebor Elohechad, Zebor Elohechad implies that that is an instruction regarding how you should construct the basin, right? This is what you do. Zebor Elohechad, Zebor Elohechad. If you're telling me that it happens to be a circumstantial case where each one rejected the other person's basin, it shouldn't be formulated as an instruction. We don't have to go through a charade every time we choose a basin whereby you have to choose one, I have to say no, I have to choose one, you have to say no, and then we have to appoint a third. If we can agree on our first try, then great. So if you're telling me it's like a circumstantial thing where they happen to disagree, why does the Mishnah formulate it as an instruction that Zebor Elohechad, Zebor Elohechad? So the Gemara rejects for two reasons the second approach. Elohachi ka'amar. Rather, this is what it means to say. Kisha Zebor Elohechad. So those two letters again appear. Kisha Zebor Elohechad, as we will see, some Gersaos in the Rishonim do not have Kisha Zebor Elohechad, something that again we will explore. But Kisha Zebor Lo Dayon Echad, Zebor Lo Dayon Echad, when Reuven appoints one judge, like we said at the outset, when Reuven appoints one judge and Shimon appoints one judge, Shnehen Borin Lohen Od Echad, the two of them will appoint a third judge together, and that's how you will end up with your court of three judges. Okay? So that's the conclusion of the Gemara. Two Havaminas, which both of which we will come back to and we will explore in further detail. But the conclusion for us is that each one appoints one judge, the two of them, or the two first judges appoint a third judge, and through that you have constructed your beis din. Now the Gemara asks a critical line. Mai shna de avdei hachi. Why would they go through this procedure? What was the purpose of having Reuven appoint one judge, Shimon appoint another judge, and the two of them appoint a third judge? The Gemara answers, Hachi Amri b'ma'arava mishmeder b'zera. Ma'arava refers to Eretz Yisrael, obviously, right? Two major geographic regions of Chazal. You have Bavel and Eretz Yisrael. Bavel being in modern Iraq, and Eretz Yisrael being in modern Israel, if we're allowed to recognize the existence of Israel as a state. So you have...
I can cut that out of the recording.
So... Well, if we're listening on their stuff, they're going to listen on ours. You have two, obviously, epicenters of Torah learning in the times of the Amoraim, Bavel and Eretz Yisrael, Talmud Bavli and Talmud Yerushalmi. When the Talmud Bavli refers to Ma'arava, right, a little geography, Iraq is east of Eretz Yisrael, so when they refer to what's west, they're referring to what the Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael would say. Amri Ma'arava v'shedu Rabbi Zeira, mitoch shezeh bor lo dayan echad v'zeh bor lo dayan echad u'shnehen borin lehen od echad yetzei hadin la'amito. Because this one appointed one judge and this one appointed another judge, through that the truth of the case will emerge, or the case will emerge truthfully, yetzei hadin la'amito. Pretty ambiguous phrase, right? Through doing that, the case will emerge truthfully. It's Adin La'amita. We're just analyzing the words. Okay? So the big question for us is going to be what exactly Yetzei Adin La'amita means. It's going to be a critical question, and that is going to be the question that more than any other opens up the sugya in terms of our understandings of conceptually what is a beis din shel zavla. So let us begin by analyzing Tosfos. The Tosfos, you either have it on your page, it's the last Tosfos, Kedesh Yetzei Adin La'amita, or it's also source number one in the packets. Okay? Tosfos are going to offer two approaches to what exactly this means. Let's just see, Kidei sheyetzei adin la'amito. And we're going to see Rashi in a moment, but Rashi is a little bit more ambiguous. Tosfos are a little more explicit. Pirush HaRivan. Rivan is one of the earlier Balei HaTosfos. The Rivan explained as follows. What does this mean? She'afilu hachayav yipara beratzon. Even the person who loses the case, that's the way we refer to somebody who loses. Chayav. And this is also an important point, which we might get back to as well. It's the first year, so there's a lot of points that we're going to get back to in the future. But chayev can mean different things. Chayev can mean obligated, right? Chayev can mean condemned. And those are different things. When we talk about your chiyuv to do something, your chiyuv to say kiddush, your chiyuv to say havdalah, doesn't mean you've been condemned in any way. It just means you have an obligation. We also use the word chayev to mean somebody who's condemned. Ploni ata zakai, ploni ata chayev. Beis din will declare somebody chayav and the other person zakai. One person loses the case, the other person wins the case. So here when we say chayav, we're referring to somebody who lost the case. The person who is, obviously in criminal law, we would say somebody who's condemned, or in case of a monetary law, the person who's obligated to pay, who lost his case. So the Rivan says, what is the purpose of this whole appointment system, because even the person who loses the case will willingly give over the money. But Yomar, and what will he say, either to himself, or he'll say this verbally, whichever, Kushta Dayane, he'll affirm that the judges ruled with truth, or that they arrived at a truthful conclusion. Kushta Dayane, She'ani be'atzmi birarti ha'echad, because I myself appointed one of them. V'im haya yachol lahapech b'schusi, haya mahapech. And if he could have, worked the case in my favor, he would have done so. Okay? Now, what's critical about the way the Rivan is quoting this? About the way he's formulating this notion? It's all in the mind of the Baal Din. He does not say that the judges should indeed act on behalf of the respective litigants who appointed them. He's saying the purpose of this is that he will think that his judge worked on his behalf, and therefore he will willingly abide by the Beis Din's decision. But nowhere does he say that the judges themselves should act that way. In contrast to the second view of Tosos, Lefum Riata Mashma, Tosos add, whoever the author of this Tosos is adding, the first impression that you would have received from reading the Gemara, Mashma Kacha Pirsh, I would have said that this is what it means. Shemitosha Birer Zeshalo Vezeshalo. Ushneha Mashlishi. I think there's a word missing here. So the Bach adds the word Ushneha Mashlishi, right? The two of them, because each one appoints his own, and the two of them appoint a third. Yeze Adin La Amito Blo Avos. The Beis Din will arrive at a truthful conclusion without any perversion of justice. Why? Sheyehei HaInyan Shakul. Because the court will be balanced. Lo Yarbu Mahapchin L'chova Al Mahapchin L'schus V'lo L'hapach. And there won't be more people advocating for one party than for the other party, or the reverse. There's a Rishonic pun here, if you're interested, right? Mahapchin b'schuso shel zeh is advocating for one or the other. Mahapchin l'chova al mahapchin l'schus, and then Tosas add velo lehepach, which sounds the similar, not there. It means the opposite. Okay, fine, great. Love the rabbinic humor. So this second position of Tosos is saying that it's not that it's in the mind of the litigants that Beis Din will act that way, and therefore they'll abide by the decision. Tosos seems to be saying, in the second approach, that indeed, the Dayanim will act that way. They will advocate for their respective parties, and the advantage of this system is that you will have a balanced Beis Din insofar as that there will be equal forces working for either side.
In the first position of Tosos, why can't it be that the judge actually is working for him, and it was 2-1?
The judge... It just doesn't seem that that's what the Rivan is saying. In other words, if that would be the case, right, if the case would be that they're each advocating for one, okay, then the advantage of the system is, like the second day of Tosos says, that it's even, right?
Saying, but let's say the actual din of the case, all three judges have to agree in order for the case to be, maybe...
No. You
maybe
always...
2-1. Maybe his judge actually did go for him and said he was right, and therefore
he
didn't feel bad.
No.
He was right.
No. It's certainly possible that his judge voted for him. And in general, by Dine Mamonis Shosha, we always abide by the majority decision, right?
So why would he think that the case... If I was right, the judge would have said something to me. Let's say the judge did. Then he thinks the verdict is not good.
No. In other words, his point is, this guy was going... I hired the best advocate that I have for my case, right? So if he made the best case that he could, and still the Beis Din decided that in other words, he rests assured that he had an advocate for his side in Beis Din.
Okay? Not just someone who's actually going to go for him, but someone actually who's going to convince the other judges.
Right, exactly. He's going to make the case for him, right? He says, if he can advocate for me, he will. And if still the Beis Din decided that it's not good, right, and you have that third unbiased judge, if still, let's say, at least, that he couldn't convince that third unbiased judge that I'm right, then look, it must be indeed the case, okay? So he rests assured that he has advocacy. Yeah.
I think this is a good case where you have two answers that reflect textual reading and a logical reading.
Okay, good.
The second one is a much, much better reading of the words. The second answer is that Yatzah Din La'amito has to mean that the resulting verdict will be true. And how do you ensure that the resulting verdict will be true is that you do a good job of exploring all of the possibilities.
Okay, so I love the fact that you said that, because then we have to assess, right, why the first position, the Rivan, rejected that. The obvious problem is...
It's disturbing that you would...
It's remarkable. It's astonishing, right? It is astonishing. So 100%. I couldn't have said it better myself. Why lafum riata? That's why I told us to say lafum riata, right? They're saying, based on just my reading of the text, this is what I would have said. And yet the Rivan is rebelling against that. Why is the Rivan rebelling against that? For obvious reason. It is remarkable, astonishing, unfathomable to the Riva that you have this court system where there are judges who are openly, and not only openly, but are expected to advocate for their respective sides without maintaining some form of unbiased willingness to just hear everyone out. It's shocking. If we just think of what a court system is supposed to be, all of everything that's said in the Torah so many times, of los akiru panim b'mishpat, and everything like that, kakaton kagadol tishma'un, about maintaining equality between the two litigants, nobody can stand while the other person's sitting. They both have to be present at all times when arguments are being forwarded. As we'll see, some hold, this is something that we'll discuss, that they both have to be present and they can't even write things in. You have to be able to see them. They have to be present before you. There's so much emphasis on the equality of the ba'alei dinim, and yet we now seem to have a Gemara that's saying that there's open advocacy for the two sides. So the question is how we explain that. And I think this really goes to the heart of the sugya of Beis Din Shel Zavla, and this is what we're going to have to explore.
Can I say something?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's kind of, I mean, based on what the first example here, when you're going into this kind of case of Dinei Mamonos, it kind of reminds me of like a Smachta Lo Kanya. So when two people are arguing about something and they both have their opinions, both of them think they're totally correct, and when they find out that they're incorrect, you know, they don't want to give over. If there was a wager, they don't want to give over their money because they thought they were right and they're being conned out of this. So okay. Right now it seems like when you're having this case where you guys are forming this Beit Din, you need to make sure that both sides are totally, you have to have the rutzon after you lose to know that I want to give it over, otherwise it's not valid. So you're going to have two people pick their horse, and then that guy's going to pick a neutral party, and that way you're going to be...
Okay, so...
The laugh is good enough.
No, it's very good. No, it's very good. It's very good. We're going to explore the Asmachta Lokanya when we get to Daf Chafei, because it happens to be the central location, happens to be in our parak. What you're saying is very good. It's not true, but it's still... It's still very good. When two people come to a Beis Din, when two people I like the conceptual direction, even though it's not really so true. When two people come to a Beis Din in order to decide a case for them, right? That's not a case of asmachta, even though you expect to win. We'll have to define the exact parameters of asmachta. What is asmachta? What we're referring to is asmachta. By asmachta is a case where you're gambling or you're asserting that gambling might not be a good example. Let's not define asmachta for now. Let's hold off on defining asmachta. But basically a case where you don't expect... Anything I say is going to get me into a minefield. But for now, you make some kind of... hyperbolic expression, what we call guzma, to give a clear example. Like, if you do X, I will give you $1 billion, right? Clearly you did not mean that, you did not expect it to happen. So that's what we call asmachta. You're not actually going to pay. Now, it is true that whenever you come before a Beis Din, you expect to win because you expect that you're right. But that's certainly not asmachta. And even in cases of full arbitration, what's the term that we use for arbitration in halacha?
Pshara.
Right? I translated pshara in the drasha as compromise. It doesn't actually mean compromise. What pshara means is arbitration. And we'll highlight that when we talk about pshara. Pshara is really a first paragraph of Sanhedrin Sugya. It comes up in Daf Vav. But we're going to have to talk about it at least tangentially when we explore Zebur Lo Echad. Even in a pshara, where it's not a formal Beis Din structure, you can't just say, oh, I didn't expect to lose, so I'm not going to pay. That would obviously undermine the entire system. The fact that you're applying asmachta here is interesting. It's not going to apply to Zeburer, but when we get to other sugyas, like Kiblu Alai, or Ne'eman Alai Abba, Ne'eman Alai Avicha, Ne'eman Alai Gemoroi Bakar, which is the sugya that appears in Daf Chav Dalet, we'll re-explore similar ideas, the notion of his chayvus and how valid his chayvus is. You can just go for it.
So just besides for Jerry's point that the Rivan couldn't fathom what the other opinion was saying, but it doesn't even answer the if you read it the second way that Tosfos understands Yetzia Din La'amito, it doesn't really answer the question of the Gemara, because the Gemara asks Maishna de Avdi Hachi, assuming that means why would we have a system where I pick one, you pick one, and then those two judges pick a third one.
Right.
So, because that way, yetei adin la'amito, that doesn't answer the question. If you want the most emestik adin, then you wouldn't have us choosing any of the judges.
Okay, good. So I'll say two things. Josh's question is effectively why, if the whole point is arriving at a truthful conclusion, what's the advantage of having a balance based in where you have plus one minus one equals zero, as opposed to having three zeros, which also equals zero? You just have three unbiased judges, then that would work as well. So the answer is twofold. One answer that I think is worth thinking about, but is not what I think the Tosfos would say, is that this may be a concession to the reality that it's very hard to find people who are totally unbiased in general. It's very hard to be really totally unbiased. We obviously strive for that, but biases have tricky ways of creeping into a person's mind, right? That's why we say, "Ki hakesef yaver pechim yisalef tevrei tzadikim." We say that. What?
It's implicit bias.
It's implicit bias.
Love that here.
Yeah. Oh, is that a thing in medical school?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Implicit bias.
Yes.
Yeah, it's implicit bias. So that's what those are talking about. It's implicit bias. I don't know what that means, but it sounds good. It sounds similar to what I'm saying.
I do online games where they like check to see like how fast you'll shoot a gun at a random person, and like they show that people will be preferential.
Oh, like implicit bias, like with police brutality,
yeah,
and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. I mean, that was part of the...
Yeah.
I think that was part of the same protest against...
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, fine.
It's, like, important in medicine, because, like, people will, like, assume that, like...
That a certain...
patients are narcotic users, even if they are.
Oh, so the biases of...
Yeah.
That sounds important.
Big problem.
Yeah. So if we have people who are actually instructed to work for a particular side, it somewhat neutralizes that problem, right? We don't have to worry about implicit bias if we have explicit bias and expected explicit bias. That's one thing. Two, what I really think Tosfos would say emerges from the Rush. So before we explore the conceptual ramifications of this machlokas, let's see the Rush, because I think the Rush will help to open up the issue. So before we see the Rush, let's see Rashi, because the Rush is really commenting on Rashi. Rashi actually has a bit of a more ambiguous formulation. Yetzei din emes la'amito. So the first three words are decisi ba'alei adinin. Decisi means they will listen. They will abide by the basin's decision. Immediately this sounds like the Rivan, right? Disavar hachayev, because he will think, Hare ani be'atzmi birarti ha'echad. I myself appointed him. Okay, and if he could have worked in my favor, he would have. Now, if you would have stopped there, you would have said that Rashi is like the Rivan, 100%, right? The emphasis is on the willingness, correct? Yeah, we all agree with that? The emphasis is on the willingness of the Baal Edinim to abide by the Beis Din's decision. And again, when he describes the process, he says, because they will think that each one is working in my favor. However, Rashi throws in another line. V'hadayonin ba'atzman, and the judges themselves, noched da'atan lahapech b'schus shnehen, will work to advocate for both of them, mipnesha shnehem birurum, because the two of them appointed them. So now he's definitely adding something about the judges themselves. The question is, what exactly is he asking? Is he adding? Sure. V'hadayonin ba'atzman, this is after the comma, right? V'hadayonin ba'atzman, and the judges themselves, noched da'atan lahapech b'schus shnehen, they direct their da'as, their intent is to work on behalf of both of them, to advocate for both of them, mipnesha shnehem birurum, because the two of them appointed them. So the question here is going to be, as Rashi, when he says shnehem, shnehem can mean two things, and here we get into English grammar. It can mean all, and it can mean each. And those are different. Does Rashi mean, when he says shnehem, that each one is indeed actually going to work on behalf of his respective Baal Din, and advocate for him? Or is he saying, no, the approach of the Dayanim should be that in the end of the day, they were both appointed by both Baal Edinim, they shouldn't pay so much attention to who appointed whom, and they should work on behalf of both of them.
It doesn't sound like that, because it says, Mivnesha Shnehem Berurum.
Mivnesha Shnehem Berurum. What does that mean?
Yeah, so if you say, like, the second shot that you just said, that V'hadayim V'atzim Nochadayim L'hapich B'zchus Shnehem, meaning they're going to try to be mahapi for each of them. They're going to try to be as
then you shouldn't
as
highlight.
Possible. Then you shouldn't have said mivnesha shnehem. What is the fact that they were...
Fair. I hear your diuk. If you're highlighting the birur, that would imply that they are actually working on their behalf.
Right.
The only reason why I have hesitancy about it is because if you look at the first half of Rashi, it really does sound like the emphasis is on the psyche of the Baalei Din.
Right.
So Rashi is sufficiently ambiguous here that people have interpreted Rashi in different ways, and that brings us to the Rush. What time is it? Alright. Do we have... I assume we're going to have 10 o'clock Marav tonight?
Yeah.
Do we have... How many people are just show by show and staying for 10 o'clock Marav? So we have a minion. So we should really end at 10 o'clock on time, because we're not going to have to wait for to call 15 people to come down so that we actually get 10. So I don't know if it's worth starting the rush right now. Okay? But let's just highlight the conceptual question that we are going to have to explore. And we're going to explore many nafkaminas of this. At a certain point, there are a lot of nafkaminas of this question. I don't know if we're going to explore all of them, because it gets a bit tedious. But as is often the case, each nafkamina contributes its own element to the sugya, so we'll see how much we're going to explore. But this question of Yetzia Din La'amito and these two approaches in Tosfos, again, it's going to require more work, but really open up the sugya and highlight two radically different approaches to what Beis Din Shel Zav Lo is all about. The basic question that the Rivan has, that you were highlighting before, is how could we have a Beis Din with explicitly biased judges who are instructed to be biased on behalf of their Batei Din? Even though the Gemara implies that, the Rivan thinks it's impossible. And as we will see, the Rush is going to object in even more strenuous and vociferous terms. He says, Chas v'shalom, that this should be the case. When Rishonim use the term Chas v'shalom, it means that they don't just disagree, they think it's a real problem. Another an example that Rav Rosenzweig highlighted was, there's a position of Rava in Maseches Avodah Zarah. It seems to imply that, we know there are three mitzvos yihari v'yavar, three mitzvos that you give your life for, right? Avodah Zarah, idolatry, gilui arayos, illicit sexual relationships, v'shvichus damin, and murder. But then the Rabbi Yishmael, quoted in the Gemara Sanhedrin, in the 8th parak, maybe we'll get there, says that there are really only two. And really, for Avodah Zarah, it's not yihari v'yavar, you violate Avodah Zarah rather than giving your life. The implication is that Rava in Maseches Avodah Zarah indeed adopts that position. We're always brought up saying that there are three, the big three sins, the three cardinal sins, that there are only two cardinal sins. And indeed, the Piskei Arid from Italy paskins that way. That there are really only two cardinal sins, not three. Tosfos note that Rava seems to hold this way and say, Chas v'shalom, that is the case. Why are Tosfos saying Chas v'shalom there? It's not just that they reject this position. Because so many Jews in Ashkenaz had given their lives, had taken their lives actively in order to avoid Avodah Zarah, it was an inconceivable conclusion to Tosfos that we should paskin like Rav. This relates to broader themes of the assumption of righteousness in Ashkenaz, that Tosfos see communal practice as a source of halacha. Again, this gets to a much broader issue, and then you get into the Chaim Soloveitchik versus Avram Grossman debates over the Crusade massacres, whatever. That's a history of halacha question. But whenever the Rishonim say Chas v'shalom, they're really adamantly protesting the position. They think there's something fundamentally wrong with it. So not only does the Rush reject the obvious reading of the Gemara, Lefum Riata, the reading of the Gemara, he thinks it's totally anathema, it's totally unacceptable. Okay? Chas v'shalom. So how can we have such a position? So then the answer lies in the basic question as to what Beis Din Shel Zav Lo is. The assumption of the Rivan, the assumption of the Rush, is that this is a Beis Din. And that's a logical assumption. We are referring to it as a Beis Din. We say, Dinei Mamonos B'Shlosha. The alternative, however, is that in light of this line of Yetzia Din La'amita and other ample evidence, which we'll examine, perhaps Beis Din Shel Zav Lo is not a Beis Din, the way we generally think of Beis Din, but is actually some elevated form of arbitration. It's an arbitration. It's not a formal court system. To highlight it in other ways, we know that in halacha there's a concept called pshara. That indeed is arbitration. There's another concept called the batei din shebechol ir ve'ir, that you have to appoint. There's a formal beis din that's appointed for each city. That's the height of formality. Where does Beis Din Shel Zav Lo fall along the spectrum between those two poles? One option we can say is that it is a totally formal beis din. It happens, the appointment method happens to be different. Instead of having them appointed by some formal communal tribune or whatever you have, It's just formulated by the two litigants themselves. But once they formulate that Beis Din, what is its power? What is its koach? It is a formal Beis Din just like any other formal Beis Din. And it has the full power of Beis Din. The alternative is that this is something much more akin to pshara. It's not Beis Din at all. We refer to it as Beis Din loosely. It might have more power than pshara. There might be some differences between this and pshara. But if we're looking at that spectrum between arbitration and din, Beis Din Shel Zav Lo might not be close to din at all. I mean, you could argue that it's 100% din, you could argue that it's 95% din, you could argue that it's much closer to pshara. If we say that, then we can begin to understand how we open up the possibility for Dayanim to advocate for their respective Baalei Din. Okay? That's going to be a broad topic that we're going to have to discuss. We're going to have to re-examine the Mishnah in light of that conceptual distinction, in light of that Chakira, and we're going to have to explore many other issues pertaining to this nature of Beis Din Shazavla in order to highlight the real conceptual nature of this Beis Din. So, Beis Din will pick up next week. I'll try to send out a review, and look forward to picking it up. Shkaya.
Josh, I think that there's a difference between three neutral people and one neutral person.